I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is April 21st, 2021. The time is 9:04 a.m. Please silence all cell phones. Thanks to all the support staff, Co-Chair Stedman, Co-Chair Wilikowski, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Von Imhoff, and Senator Wilson. Today's agenda, SB 20, out-of-state teacher reciprocity, SB 71, Council on the Arts, plates, and manage art, Senate Bill 88, State Insurance Catastrophic Reserve Account, SB 10, free and reduced tuition for essential workers. SB 20 is our first bill up this morning. This is a third hearing. We've heard invited and public testimony on March 29th. Our intention is to consider a committee substitute which covers fiscal notes and look to the will of the committee. Senator Wilson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Finance Committee to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 20, Finance 32-LS0202/G before the committee as our working document.
Thank you, and I'll object for discussion. Ms. Schein, would you bring yourself on, put yourself on the record?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Erin Schein. I'm staff to co-chair Bishop and the Senate Finance Committee. The CS before you incorporates the amendment that was adopted in the previous hearing on this bill. On page 2, lines 20 through 21 and 24 through 25, it reduced the time period for an out-of-state teacher to complete course trainings required in AS 14-20-020-K from 2 years to 90 days.
Thank you. Questions to the changes to the CS? Seeing none, I remove my objection. Is there a further objection to adopting our CS as our working document? We have Mr. Lampkin from Senator Stevens' office here available for questions. Seeing no questions, Senator Von Imhoff, could you cover the fiscal notes, please?
Yes, we have a fiscal note from the Department of Education Early Development, OMB component number 1240. It looks to be appropriation requested for fiscal year 2022. I believe that's $6,000 from the general fund UGF. Did I get that right?
Yep.
Okay. It basically states that an educator with a valid out-of-state teaching certificate will qualify for an Alaska teaching certificate. They have 2 years to satisfy the Alaska Studies and Multicultural coursework, and then with this new amendment, 90 days to do the other coursework. The Department of Education and Early Development would also be required to adopt a process to expedite the issuance of a certificate to a spouse of an active duty member of the Armed Forces of the United States. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, can we afford this fiscal note?
Well, we're going to find out here real quick. Thank you for that. Any further discussion? Committee action, looking to the will of the committee. Are we ready to move this bill? All right. Senate Bill 20 moves from committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Finance Committee adopt, I'm sorry, moves. The committee substitute for Senate Bill 20, Finance 32-LS0202/G from committee with attached physical notes and individual committee recommendations.
Thank you. Now we'll take a brief at ease and sign the committee documents. Thank you. Senate Bill 71, Council on the Arts, Plates, and Manage Art. This is the third hearing on Senate Bill 71. We've heard public testimony on April the 6th. Our intention is, again, to consider a committee substitute, cover fiscal notes, and look to the will of the committee. Senator Olson,
could you move the CS?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that the Finance Committee adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill 71, Finance, which is 32-LSO310/W, before the committee and use that as our working document.
Thank you, and I'll object for discussion. Ms. Schein?
Again, for the record, this is Erin Schein, staff to Co-Chair Bishop in the Senate Finance Committee. The CS before you, version W, incorporates the amendments that were adopted in the committee in the previous hearing. The first change is a title amendment which adds establishing the Alaska Arts and Cultural Investment Fund. Section 1 of the bill, page 2, lines 12 through 13, are conforming changes to the new Section 6 that I'll highlight in a second. The next change is in Section 2, page 2, lines 14 and 15, which adds the Alaska Arts and Cultural Investment Fund created in Section 6 to AS 3705-146C. The next change is in Section 4, which is on page 3, line 11, which adds the management of the Alaska Arts and Cultural Investment Fund to the duties of the Alaska State Council on the Arts. Section 6 is the adds a new section creating the Alaska Arts and Cultural Investment Fund. This fund is created in the general fund and consists of money appropriated by the legislature, including donations, monies from other sources, and interest earned on the fund. The other change that's in the CS is there was a previous section number 5 in version I that was removed. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that introduction. Any discussion? I'm going to remove my objection. Any questions? Senator Wilikowski, could you cover the fiscal note, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there are two fiscal notes. The first one is OMB component 3193. That is for an expenditure of $6,000, a one-time increment, is included for legal fees to implement the necessary regulation changes and for policy review. The second fiscal note is OMB component number 2348, and that projects the revenue that would be generated from 2,778 license plates that are expected. The cost increase going from $30 to $50 is projected to raise $55,560 in FY22 and every year out to FY 2027.
Thank you. All right. Any further discussion? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the committee substitute for Senate Bill 71 back finance 32 LSO 310 / W be moved from committee with the attached fiscal notes and the individual recommendations.
Thank you. Senate Bill 71 has moved from committee. Senate Bill 88, State Insurance Catastrophic Reserve Account. This is our first hearing on this bill. Our intention is to hear and hold the bill. Bill's introduction, presentation, and analysis will be by Mr. Scott Jordan, Director of Risk Management. And we're going to take a brief at ease while we get the screen set up. Mr. Bailey, you're going to run the slides. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
You look very squared away down there, so that's good. Mr. Jordan, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
If you put yourself on the record and please walk us through the Senate Bill 88.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and committee members of the Senate Finance for allowing me to present SB 88. For the record, My name is Scott Jordan. I'm the Director of Risk Management for the Department of Administration. Next slide, please. The can you hear me okay?
We can.
Okay, great, thank you. Slide two, the purpose of this bill is to allow us to change the CAT fund from an unencumbered balance of $5 million to $50 million. This will allow us to self-insure for our property coverage. We currently have two lines of business that we self-insure for, workers' comp, which we've been doing since 1992, and then general liability since 2002. The reason we want to self-insure is the global property insurance markets have hardened over the last 3 years, and last year we saw a 30% increase in our premium costs from 20 to 21, and we're being told this year to expect another 15 to 20% for FY22. Currently, the limit that we can purchase for catastrophic coverage right now in the market is $50 million for an annual premium, and we would be able to save that premium if we were self-insuring. Next slide, please. This is a slide of what other states are doing. I sent out a message through the State Risk and Insurance Management Association, or STREMA, asking what other states are doing to combat the rising premiums in property coverage. We've got a mixed type of answers. Some are just paying the higher premiums due to the fact that they benefited from some FEMA claims paid, and within FEMA's rules, once they've paid a claim, you have to obtain and maintain agreements with FEMA, which causes you to keep coverage, excess coverage. Some of the other states are doing a captive plan, which is essentially a self-insured plan. However, it's managed by a captive entity. And those can be grouped together or they can be individual captive plans. And some of the other states that we spoke to are just increasing their self-insured retention, or basically it's the same thing as a deductible. And in some cases, those self-insured retentions are at $40 to $50 million. So they're paying the first $40 to $50 million before any insurance kicks in. And then lastly, some of the other states are coming off of what they call a multi-year premium price guarantees. So they've had price guarantees for their premiums set 2 years ago. Some of them could be longer than that. However, they know this year when they come off of those guarantees, they're going to be hit with pretty close to the 30 plus the 15 to 20%. It's almost a 50% increase. So next slide, please.
Senator Von Imhoff and Senator Stedman both have questions, and Senator Von Imhoff is first.
Thank you. So the slide two that we're looking at, the header is expenditures from the CAT fund since inception. It does not say what other states are doing. Did I read this slide incorrectly?
I'm sorry, you're on slide two.
And it's titled expenditures from the CAT fund since inception.
I apologize. I looks like I have a different order than what was sent over to you.
So which slide that you just spoke about, which slide is that?
I have it as slide three, the one the other states have.
No, sir. I looked ahead at your slides, and I do not see a slide that titles what other states are doing.
I apologize. We must have sent over a non-updated slide deck. Yep, I don't.
You want to take a pause real quickly?
Yes.
Brief it in. 10-minute recess.
We just go through what he's got, and then if there's different stuff, rather than waste.
At ease, 10 minutes.
No matter.
We're back. Follow along. Okay, we're on the record. Here we go.
I can think out of the box.
All right, Mr. Jordan, let's take it from the top.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for the confusion there.
If this is the most confusion we have all session, we have hit a home run, so don't worry about it.
All right. Appreciate that. If we can start on slide 2, the heading of it should be purpose.
Correct.
Okay. So, again, the purpose of SB 88 is to change the CAT fund unencumbered balance from $5 million to $50 million. The purpose for doing that is so that the state can self-insure for its property coverage, which we currently do with two other lines of business, workers' comp, which we started in 1992, and general liability, which we started in 2002. The reason we want to self-insure for the property coverage is the global property insurance market is what they call hardening or has less capacity. And we're looking at a 30% increase for insurance premiums from FY 20 to 21. And we're being told to expect another 15 to 20% for FY 22. The current limit that we purchase for catastrophic coverage for property insurance is $50 million for an annual premium. And we're hoping to save that annual premium.
Okay.
Next slide, please. Slide 3.
Senator Stedman.
And so if we set up the self-insurance program, is this going to include a sinking fund in the premiums that you supposedly won't be paying?
Through the chair, I'm not familiar with the term sinking fund, but what this will do is we will not be paying any premiums to excess insurance for property loss, and that will reflect in a reduction to the agencies and rates.
Follow up, Senator Stedman.
So the reduction in the premiums that the agencies would be paying, explain to me where that money is going to go.
Through the chair to Senator Stedman, we're reducing our rates. That's what the fiscal note reflects. And I'm not sure what other agencies are doing to reduce, to offset that reduction.
Senator, name off?
So thank you. I think if I had to add on to that, what's the amount? I don't know if you may have stated it, but what's the amount that they're saving on an annual? You will be saving on an annual basis that you wouldn't have to pay for a premium. And then number two, would it make sense to take that at least some or partial of that amount and set it aside for future catastrophic losses to help support this fund?
Through the chair, that is kind of what the intention is. The savings we anticipate for the first year is going to be about $3 million. And then we're hoping that we're going to be seeing a savings of up to $6 million by FY25. And the set aside will be the catastrophic fund. So if we pay anything out of the catastrophic fund for any type of losses, those funds would go back into the CAT fund to a maximum amount of $50 million.
One follow up. So in this presentation, then, so we're not going to start off with $50 million in this fund. We're going to start off with zero and slowly feed it each year with the premium over time until we finally, after 8 years or so, have $50 million in it. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's somewhat correct. So right now we have $5 million in the fund. That's the max amount that we can have in that fund, and we have not used any for this year. The sweep that we do annually, or that Division of Finance does annually, is going to allow us to increase this to $50 million. Hopefully we'll get most of that this year. I have a slide farther on down that explains the sweep process and what the potential is for us to fill that fund to the full $50 million. So it shouldn't take several years. It should take maybe a couple years.
Senator Stubman, I think I inadvertently cut you off. Did you have a follow-up question?
Well, I think Senator Von Imhoff helped with that because it, frankly, was question wasn't answered. We're trying to track the cash flow here at the table. And are the agencies still going to be billed the $5 million? Or is this, and maybe it's later in the plan, I want to be clear, if the agency is going to be billed the $5 million, that's one thing. If we just let them keep the $5 million, that's a whole other issue. Then we need to go ahead and look at budget reductions within those agencies or something. So we need to get a good idea as we go through this. What I was referring to, the sinking fund, was basically the $50 million set aside, same thing. And then I'd like to have a little bit of history on our loss, which is, I guess, later in the packet to make sure we can understand kind of the risk exposure we have. And then a somewhat conversation on why they think we're substantially different from the broader marketplace that's driving these premiums up 30% and 15%.
So Mr. Jordan? Through the chair to Senator Stebbins, hopefully I can answer some of your questions. The reduction that we're going to see is we anticipate a $3 million reduction in what we're going to have to pay in premiums for property insurance. That reduction is going to be passed to the agencies. I believe there is somebody from OMB on the phone that can maybe answer what the agencies intend to do with that savings. It's beyond what we looked at as far as how they're going to deal with that savings.
Paloma Harbor is online at Office of Management and Budget. If you'd like to add anything to the conversation, Paloma.
Yes, Chair Bishop. For the record, Paloma Harbor with the Office of Management and Budget. So any savings realized in risk management will be spread out to the agencies. They will be billed less in their rates. We usually adjust risk management rates during the budget process each fiscal year, and you see increases or decreases as salary adjustments or adjusted base increments or decrements.
Thank you. Senator Stubman, is that sufficient?
For now.
Yep. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you explain what legally the CAP fund is responsible for paying?
Through the chair, I do have a slide a couple down that is the entire statute, but basically the CAT fund can be used for catastrophic losses, of course. It can be used for paying claim settlements, and it can be used for paying insurance premiums. However, if we were to use this, if we were not to increase this fund and use the entire amount for just paying the increased insurance premiums, we wouldn't have anything left to pay any kind of catastrophic losses.
Follow up?
Yeah, and I saw that slide, and I'm trying to understand what is considered to be a catastrophic loss. Is that state property? How is that defined?
Yeah, through the chair, catastrophic losses are typically earthquake and flood for the state of Alaska. Going down south, you have to deal with tornadoes and hurricanes. But for us, a catastrophic loss would be typically property driven. We have used the CAT fund in the past to pay settlement claims, judgments, things like that. But typically it's used for what I'll term first party losses, which is losses to the state, such as property, It could be vessels, ferry vessels, or you know, public safety vessels, and then of course aircrafts. And I've got a slide farther on down that shows some of the larger claims that we've used it for.
Thank you. Just a follow-up.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've looked through the slides, and when you say catastrophic losses from an earthquake, flood, fire, you're talking about state assets. If there's an earthquake, it destroys a state building, that would be covered. But if it destroys a municipal building, someone's private property, that is not covered. Is that correct?
Yeah, through the chair, that is correct. This fund is strictly for paying state claims.
Okay, but then I see later on you have like PFAS claims. PFAS, is that paying to a private company, or is that state loss? Is that paying out to a private individual or private corporation?
Through the chair, the PFAS claims are paid out to individuals, but they are liability claims against the state, so they are state claims.
Thank you. And then Senator Von Imhoff, and then I want to come back to the PFAS question. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I think when we get to slide 7, is the 10-year history of property payments compared to all lines of business. I think that will probably be helpful, because just to confirm, this is what we're talking about here is property only. Or is that like what I would call like replacement insurance? Or are we talking about liability insurance as well that is associated with property?
Through the chair, this fund can pay any of those claims. In other words, it can pay a property claim or it can pay a liability claim. The intent of raising this up to $50 million is to cover us for self-insuring for our property claims. So that would be buildings, structures, things like that, to where if we had a catastrophic loss, we would be able to handle a larger claim than, let's say, what the current fund is at $5 million.
Follow up.
So thank you. The fact that it can cover any number of things is a little worrisome, only because we had two catastrophic events. We had a 7.2 earthquake in November of 2018, and this committee can help me here, but I thought there was something to the tune of $35 million of UGF that we spent on that, and that was just, I think we spent even more over the whole course of it. And then we had wildfires all around South Central, North and South, and I think we were spending, outside of federal funds, you know, tens of millions, if not to the point of hundreds of millions of dollars of UGF. Would this insurance fund of $50 million, number one, it could be depleted pretty darn quick, and number two, would this be the source of funds for these type of payments?
Through the chair, currently this fund is used to pay what we would pay on insurance claims. So in other words, for a property loss, for instance, let's look at the earthquake losses. We did pay out on earthquake losses, but there were losses such as the road collapses, bridges collapses. Those are not covered by insurance, and that would not have been paid out of this fund.
Senator Stedman.
Oh, just as a comment, let's try to stay away from acronyms in the conversation so people can follow it, because it can get confusing. So just going to make things easier for everybody to understand what's going on, especially people at home and myself.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Olson, you had a question, sir?
No, I didn't, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry. Senator Wilson, and then Senator Wilikowski.
Yes, thank you. To follow up on Senator Von Imhoff's questions on the sort of the amount, what about a catastrophic event that happened in Kodiak at our space center out there? Would $40 million be enough to cover that cost of what happened in the explosion?
Yeah, through the chair to Senator Wilson, we did pay out on that claim. That was a total of about $35 million claim. We paid about $1.5 million out of this catastrophic fund, and the insurance company paid the balance and then subrogated or collected against the customer who owned the rocket that had exploded. So our insurance paid $17 million, the customer paid $17 million, and out of risk management's funds or the catastrophic fund, we paid about $1.5
million. Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it fair to say that this is like increasing your deductible, increasing the state's deductible from $5 million to $50 million? Is that fair?
Through the chair, you could look at it this way. Currently, our property, excess property coverage has $1 million retention, which is really a deductible. This would completely self-insure us, so there wouldn't really be any deductible that we're paying. It would just be a fund that if we had claims that exceeded $5 million, which is the current fund, that we would be able to cover those.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I'm worried about this. I could see this fund being wiped out in one or two events. Does it make sense to take a page out of health insurance, maybe do a higher deductible, but still be insured for catastrophic events with the insurance company? Is that something that your department has looked at?
Through the chair, we are going to be looking at that this year right now. In case this doesn't pass, we have to deal with the rising premium cost, and there's going to be several different things we look at. And I apologize, what I was talking about earlier when you guys did not see the slide on what other states are doing, that is one of the solutions that some of the other states are doing, is raising their deductible or their retention. And in some cases, they're raising it $50 million, excuse me. In 2012, we dealt with kind of the same issue. And what the state ended up doing was we self-insured property under $5 million based on the balance of the CAT fund. So any property that was under $5 million was not on our insurance property schedule. Any property over was on the schedule. And at the time, we were told by the insurance market that it was better to lower your total insured values than it was to raise your retention or your deductible up.
Okay, Senator Wilikowski, did I cut you off, sir? I apologize.
No, but I just had another question. I'm not completely clear on how this fund works, but I can do some research offline. But by raising this from $5 million to $50 million, what does that mean? Our maximum liability is $50 million? Now, let's say there's a catastrophic event, state-caused wildfire causes hundreds of millions of damages. We're still responsible for that, right? Does this cap our maximum liability?
Through the chair, this does not cap anything. This just allows us to have access to up to $50 million. Currently, we purchase $50 million in catastrophic losses. So let's say we have a flood or an earthquake considered a catastrophic loss, and it exceeds $50 million. We only have coverage up to $50 million. Anything above that, likely agencies would be coming to the legislature for appropriation to replace or repair buildings.
Thank you. Any further questions from the table? Seeing none. I just want one question for me is as we see these premiums increases, and we all know what are driving them, is do states go to the same pool for purchasing their insurance, or do they go to different providers, or have you talked to your peers in other states about forming a coalition to buy your insurance to keep your premiums down?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. I don't believe that state have gone to trying to do a coalition, but the answer to your first question is yes. They go to the London market, there's a Bermuda market, which we have not been involved in, and there's also a domestic market. And typically for for us anyway, and this is typical with most state agencies, they're insuring such high amounts that it takes five and six companies and two and three layers. So right now we have three layers. We have, of course, our retention, and we have up to $25 million, and that has a group of insurance carriers on it. And then we have $25 to $50 million. That's another group of insurance carriers. And then we have currently $50 to $150 million, which is another group of carriers. So it takes quite a bit of coordination and market capacity to cover just us, and every other state has similar challenges.
Thank you. Okay, if we can, I think we can move to the next slide.
Okay, slide three, please. This is what other states are doing. So I reached out to our State Risk and Insurance Management Association group, STREMA, and asked what they were doing to combat the rising premiums that they're seeing. And a few of them, mostly in the Southeast, are just paying the higher premiums because they have benefited from a FEMA payment on claims for a catastrophic loss. And FEMA requires that you obtain and maintain. And that what that means is you obtain insurance and you maintain that insurance. And so if you have benefited from a FEMA claim, you are required to have that. So they're just continuing to pay the higher premiums. Some have gone to captive plans, and a captive plan is really kind of a self-insured plan. You use your own capital, but the captive entity manages that, and you can have a couple different kinds of captive plans. You can have a sole captive, which is just your insurance interest or your claims interest, or you can have a captive that might do two or three different, which goes back to your question, Mr. Chairman, that may be where you look at a kind of a coalition of states going into one captive plan. And then the final is we're looking at, or some of the states are looking at, just increasing their self-insured retention. So the insurance companies aren't on the hook for, you know, smaller claims, 5 to 10 million. The states are having $40 to $50 million retentions, which theoretically will lower their premiums or at least flatten their premiums for this year. And then the final answer that we got from some of the states is they're coming off of multi-year premium price guarantees. So they were intuitive enough to, two or three years ago, ask for price guarantees, and they would pay that for the next 3 years. However, as they come off of those price guarantees, they're going to be looking at the full 40 to 50% increase. So they are wondering what they're going to be doing with their plan for that this year because of coming off of those price guarantees.
Senator Stubman.
Thank you. I'd like a little bit of help with the Federal Emergency Management Group, or good old FEMA. Did you tell us that the states that had claims with FEMA, there's a commitment with FEMA, which is federal, that they can't go out and insure themselves some other direction? They're stuck with FEMA? There's some kind of agreement with FEMA for that? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Stubman, it's what FEMA has is what they call an obtain and maintain, and that's quoted right out of their manual. We have talked to FEMA. I talked to both Department of Military and Veteran Affairs, Homeland Security, and FEMA, and we talked about doing this increase in the CAT fund to $50 million, and would we meet the requirement, because we have benefited from some FEMA payments, and they said yes. We just need to submit the agreement with them, and they would agree that would show to them that we are obtaining and maintaining an insurance policy, even though it's a self-insured program.
So if I could get a little more further explanation on that. So those FEMA claims, they're state claims?
Is that correct? Through the chair, correct, yes. Yeah. So we've got a few structures that were damaged from the earthquake that that they are requesting FEMA pay these claims. And we've agreed to pay these claims, but the agencies have wanted to turn in FEMA for things that are not covered by us. So, for instance, if it's not directly related to a structural damage, it might be a sidewalk or like the road collapse in Anchorage, they can get FEMA funds. And by doing that, then we are agreeing to the obtain and maintain agreement that FEMA has.
If I could just, Mr. Chairman, so there's going to be premiums then paid to FEMA or not?
There are no, through the chair, sorry, Senator Stubbin, there are no premiums paid to FEMA. It's what FEMA does is you agree, once they've made a payment, you agree to this obtain and maintain, and all you're doing is agreeing to maintain insurance on that structure from now on. And if you don't, and it has damage again from whatever reason, earthquake, flood, whatever the cause is, then they may not provide coverage for that building.
Okay, if I could, just one last quick comment, Mr. Chairman. We've been working in the office for a couple of years on a package dealing with FEMA for our citizens, in that when you look at the way the FEMA structures or premium payments is in classifications nationwide. So our citizens in Alaska are paying premiums that are being driven out of the Gulf of Mexico and off the East Coast hurricanes. And we have huge losses in those areas, FEMA does. And the citizens of Alaska are paying premiums to FEMA and getting pittance back in claims. So we'll be having that stuff come before the committee here at some point when we finish off the working of the bill. We've been working with the Division of Insurance for quite some time, trying to figure out how to get our citizens out from underneath the federal regulatory environment of FEMA and the exposure in the Mississippi drainage, the Gulf of Mexico, and the hurricanes coming off of the Atlantic, which are driving our costs up through the roof, along with all kinds of restrictions, building restrictions that FEMA imposes, and the threat of not coming to the assistance of the people if they don't pay, which is a rate that the Division of Insurance would never, under the regulatory environment, would never allow an insurance company to charge. So we'll be talking about that. So it's a little different than this twist here, but it is a significant issue that our citizens from around the state are facing.
I'd like to go back and recapture the conversation between Senator Stedman and yourself, Mr. Jordan, on the obtain and maintain agreements. This is what I heard, and if I'm wrong, correct me, because sometimes my zeal outruns my knowledge. But the obtain and maintain agreement, Building A is state of Alaska owned. FEMA pays for the destruction. If we want to continue having FEMA pay for that building in a future event, we have to enter into an obtain and maintain agreement with FEMA. If we don't and it goes down again, that's on us.
That is essentially correct, Mr. Chair. There is no written agreement per se that I'm aware of, but if that same building, FEMA keeps track of those buildings, and if that same building was to be damaged in a future event and we did not have any type of insurance to cover that, basically we were uninsured, they could elect not to pay any damages on that building.
Thank you. And just to comment on Senator Stedman's bill he's been working on, I wish he'd hurry up because my flood insurance premiums went up again from FEMA. Thank you. Next.
Well, and if I may comment on Senator Stedman's comments, we're running into the same issue with the global market. I mean, obviously Alaska is not does not have large claims, but we're dealing with the capacity issue from other parts of the states and world, if you will, that have had catastrophic losses. So it's payments made out on other catastrophic losses that are affecting our rates. So I understand exactly what Senator Stedman was referring to.
Thank you. Further questions? Are we finished with this slide?
We are. Slide four, please. This is essentially the catastrophic reserve account statute. It's section 3705289. I've highlighted a couple of key areas. And this was a question that was asked previously. The assets of the account may be used to obtain insurance, establish reserves for the self-insurance program, and to satisfy claims or judgments arising under the program. And then the other two highlighted areas just show right now that we're at a $5 million unencumbered cap on the fund.
Thank you. Any questions on this slide? Next slide, please.
Okay. Slide five, please. This shows or demonstrates the expenditures that we've had from the CAT fund since its inception in fiscal year 88. There's a lot of numbers there, but if you go over to the right-hand side, that shows what was expended each year. And then down at the bottom, it shows the total of about $149 million that's been expended out of this fund since 1988, which works out to about $4.5 million a year, which I guess shows that the $5 million that was originally set up in 1988 has been sufficient until now. I think with the if we were trying to self-insure with a limit of $5 million, it wouldn't work. We'd have to raise it up to some amount, and $50 million is the amount that we can currently purchase. So that's the amount that we've selected to have in that fund.
Thank you. Questions? So you answered my question. $4.5 million a year average claims.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilikowski.
I'm just wondering if the amount needed is going to rise to the amount that we have. In other words, we've had $5 million. We've gotten pretty close to it. I'm wondering if we raise it to 50, if we're going to start seeing these amount needed jump to 48, 49 million every year.
Through the chair, all I can say is I certainly hope not, but I've got a slide farther on down that shows kind of the historical claims that we've paid out in the last 10 years, and we're just not seeing your standard run-of-the-mill fire, water, loss type claims that exceed even $5 million. The largest claim that we've had was in 2014. It was the Crystal Lake hatchery in Petersburg, and it was about a $4.2 million claim. So hopefully we're not going to see an increase in just the run-of-the-mill claims that typically we can pay for out of our yearly appropriation. This fund is really to capture any kind of unexpected catastrophic loss that we may have, like the earthquake. If we would have had more structural damage out of that earthquake, this fund would have addressed that.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
Just curious, so looking at like FY05, looks like you used the full $5 million. Am I reading that right?
Correct.
And then in FY06, you had 20 cents left over. FY07, you had $76.28 left over. I'm just wondering, like in those years, how much could you have used? What were the liabilities? And then in other years, I mean, you go down to FY13, you had $1,800, FY14, $76. There's years where you've gotten pretty close to $5 million. And I'm just curious, had you had $50 million, how much would you have spent in those years?
Through the chair, that's a good question. If we spent up to $5 million, obviously we had to stop at that $5 million. But and certainly looking back at maybe those years in expenditures, there were claims that were possibly paid under the judgment bill, for instance, instead of under the CAT fund, because there was no funding under the CAT fund. But my plan and practice is to continue doing exactly what we are doing, and that is to pay the claims that are unexpected to risk management. In other words, they're larger than we anticipated in our budget, and we would pay them out of this fund. I don't anticipate us paying claims, your standard run-of-the-mill claims, beyond what we're looking at here. There has been some years, if you look over on the right-hand side, there has been some years I believe FY92, where we expended $10 million. And that can be for a couple of different reasons. It could be that we had $10 million in losses that year. But the other reason could be that this fund, we encumber the funds, and let's say we encumber, you know, for the earthquake, $2 million, and we did that in FY18. We're just now paying some of our earthquake claims. So we may encumber it in 18 and not pay it out until 20 or 21 when the agency is ready to make the repairs or the replacement.
Senator Stedman?
So you mentioned 10,000 in it, or 10, I guess. The 5 million number, I think, is what you mentioned back in 88 or 89, whenever they set the program up. And then you fast forward to currently, that inflation adjusted is about double that, from 5 to 10. And can you help the committee with your process you went through on using the inflation adjusted numbers? Because clearly, you know, somewhere around 10 million would be equivalent to 5 million in the 1990 ballpark numbers. So could you help us with that?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I agree with you completely. There's obviously been some inflation since 1988. The fund has stayed at 5 million, and we have just been able to deal with that fund being at 5 million now. The risk management appropriations have obviously increased since 1988. I can't tell you what the budget was in 1988. I wasn't here, but when I started in 1998, the budget was about 30 to 32 million, and now our budget is about 41 million. So, you know, our yearly appropriation budget has increased to deal with increased standard costs and claims, and not necessarily these unexpected claims.
Thank you. I'd just like to make a point that to Senator Stedman's question, you know, we have we don't even follow the 1% rule on our deferred maintenance in the state, and that should be annually over $100 million a year deferred maintenance budget, and your slide here is reflecting to Senator Stedman's point. So thank you. Any further questions? Next slide.
Number six. This just shows a 10-year history of property premiums versus losses. The blue line is the property premiums that we've paid over the last 10 years or since FY10. And you can see for essentially the same coverage that we have right now, in FY10 we were paying $2 million for that coverage. And in FY20 we're now paying, or we paid about $5.1 million. We've had some increases along the way. We had what I would consider a substantial one in from FY11 to 12. And that is where, as I explained previously, where we elected to not insure or not put on the property schedule anyway, any property that was under 5 million. And that was in hopes of keeping that increase, lower. I mean, we were being told another 25 to 30% increase again, we made that adjustment and kept that increase lower. From probably 13 on to 17, 18, it was fairly flat. Some of those increases are due to total insured values of the property going up. But then in FY18, we started seeing a substantial increase again. And the market has just gotten harder and harder. It makes it difficult for our brokers to place our property insurance. In some cases, we're being told that they may not be able to fill the capacity. We have about $7.2 billion in total insured values. So it's a difficult placement. Not to say that other states aren't, but ours has been difficult in the past. So the orange line is the property losses that we have paid. This is not any funds that have come from insurance companies. This is all amounts that we've paid out of risk management's appropriation or the CAT fund. And we had, the spike in FY15 was the Crystal Lake Hatchery in March of 2014. And then again in FY20, we paid out two different types of claims. One was some of the earthquake claims from November 2018, And then the last one there on the notes down below is a $1 million retention we paid on a DOT maintenance shop that had a snow collapse in McGrath. So that loss is going to be probably around $3.8 million, and our retention is $1 million. So the insurance company is going to pay out the difference to rebuild that building.
Senator Von Imhoff, then Senator Stedman.
Thank you. So you mentioned that it's just getting harder to find insurers. So what's happening? Are there insurance companies that are just leaving the market, choosing to leave the market? Are they being financially forced to leave the market because they're becoming bankrupt just due to excessive payments out in the states, hurricanes, tornadoes, flooding, and so forth? I mean, what's happening with the insurance market that it's becoming so tight?
Through the chair, you've hit on all of them. For every one of those reasons, we're seeing the capacity, which is the ability for the market to insure insureds, has gone down. So there are some companies that have gone out of business due to catastrophic losses down south. There's some that are just tightening their belts and saying, you know, we haven't made any profit in the last 3 years, so we're going to increase our premiums, and you know, we're only going to take the cream of the crop. So, you know, fortunately for the state, we don't have a lot of losses, and we're a pretty good client. But if you take a state that has, you know, quite a bit of losses in the last 5 years, you know, you may see insurance companies say, no, it's too much of a risk. We're not going to insure that state or that company or, you know, whatever the case may be. So when the capacity starts going down, the premiums go up, and it just makes it harder and harder to try and fill that entire amount that we're looking for.
Senator Stedman and Senator Wilikowski.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I was kind of curious on that one loss, the $1 million retention for the DOT shop due to the snow collapse in McGrath. Why wouldn't they just put that in their budget and along with all their other maintenance issues? It doesn't seem to me to be too big of a number that DOT to, I mean, we've all seen the DOT budget over time. There's some pretty big numbers in there. I'm just kind of curious, maybe you could help us with that a little bit, why some of these things like that in particular wouldn't be just absorbed in the normal operation of the agency itself, public facilities.
Through the chair to Senator Stedman, in our program covers it. So if they have a snow collapse, obviously they're going to turn to us as the insurance provider to pay these losses. But your question is a good question. I mean, if they, I do know that in some cases we've dealt with DOT where they have an old building that might have collapsed or had a fire, and they want to put back a much bigger building. The amount that we pay on that building does not afford putting back a bigger building. So they do either come to the legislature for appropriation or work it into their budget.
I just can't help but add that we should take the lessons learned and never let that happen again. You know, DOT's in charge of our building maintenance, and we ought to know what the snow load factor is on all our shops and pay attention to the snow load for starters. Next.
All right, next slide, please.
Oh, Senator Wilikowski, I apologize.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The roughly $5 million spent each year would have been with catastrophic insurance claims paid by insurance companies, if I understand correctly. So it could be potentially a lot of money paid out above $5 million after passing this bill. And I'm just interested in your thoughts on how much we could really save versus paying the higher premiums.
Through the chair, the $5 million premium that we pay is strictly for property coverage. So, you know, it's a good question. I don't know that I have a great answer for it. The catastrophic fund or the CAT fund has paid other losses besides property. This bill, however, is proposing that we increase it to 50 so that we can completely self-insure. So, you know, hopefully we're going to show a savings. I mean, if this increases another 15 to 20% in FY22 and we're paying, you know, $7 million, let's say, in premium, it doesn't take very many years before we've saved that $50 million. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's, but yeah, it's hard to figure that, you know, are we saving money by self-insuring, or are we saving money by buying high excess limits?
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So you just made a comment. I'm just trying to make sure I understand. This is for building replacement, but you made a comment that maybe there's other payments as well, and I'll give you an example. With the 2020 paid the DOT maintenance shop that snow collapsed in McGrath, so it's $1 million to fix the shop, replace the shop, whatever. What if there was two DOT workers inside the shop and they got crushed to death and died? Where would that money come from to pay those liability claims?
Through the chair, those would be, if they're DOT employees, those would be paid under workers' comp. And we don't use the CAT fund to pay workers' comp. Workers' comp payments come strictly out of our yearly appropriation. But I understand what your question is. And it, you know, in this particular case with that snow collapse, the total that we think we're going to be looking at for this loss is about $3.8 million. So our retention at that time was $1 million, and the insurance company is going to step up and pay the other $2.8 million. So we will eventually benefit from having that excess insurance. It's just, do we need that? It's $2.8 million. If we have a CAT fund at $50 million, it would cover that, and we wouldn't have paid a $5 million premium to get that $2.5 million back, or $2.8 million back.
On
follow-up, then, yes. Senator Wilikowski.
So then on that note, am I seeing a graph here where it shows what we paid? Is that slide 5, what we paid and what we got from insurance, third-party recoveries and miscellaneous receipts, or
Through the chair, are you referring to slide 6?
Well, in my packet, it's slide 5. It said expenditures from the CAT fund since inception. I guess what it is what value have we received from our insurance payments over time? How much has insurance paid out since 1988 for our premiums paid? What have we gotten back?
Through the chair, I don't know that I could go back to FY88, but I can certainly go back in time. We did run that very question back to FY10, and there's only been one payment since FY10 to FY20, and that sort of payment from the snow collapse. But between 10 and 20, we only saw one, and that was the Alaska Aerospace.
So my last question. Sir, I think it would be very helpful for this committee to see that report, to see how much we have paid each year in premiums and how much we have received back from insurance claims and how much the state has paid in each one of those years from fiscal year 10 to the present. To me, that's a very powerful slide that will show the value of your argument. And I'm not seeing that in this presentation.
On slide 6, and we can certainly do that, Senator. On slide 6, the property losses that you see there are the property losses that we have paid. That's all funds that we have paid. That's not funds that we've gotten from the insurance company. The only one that we have received funds from was in FY, I believe we actually got the funds back in FY18 for the Alaska Aerospace incident, which took place in FY14, actually. And it was a substantial amount. I would agree that we benefited from having insurance at that point. But again, it was $34 million, and this fund we're hoping to have the capacity at $50 million. So it would still have covered that loss without paying any premiums to cover that loss. So, but I can certainly go back beyond FY10 and just see what kind of benefits we've obtained from insurance companies, what we've paid out, and what our premiums have been.
Thank you. Get that to the committee, to my office, and we'll distribute it.
Will do, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are we finished with this slide, committee members? Next slide.
Slide number 7 is just, again, a 10-year look back at property premiums versus all of our premiums. So the top portion of that spreadsheet is the property premiums we've paid since FY10, and that's about $39 million. And then our overall, which is the bottom portion, is $80 million. So you can see about half of our premiums that we pay out every year for excess insurance is in property. And remember, we don't get excess insurance for workers' comp and liability, and those are two of our big areas that we pay out in claims every year. Matter of fact, workers' comp is about 60 to 65% of our business every year. So so when we're looking at all those premiums there, we're looking at aviation, marine, and property, and then there's some smaller policies for fine arts and things like that, but majority of our premiums are paid out in aviation, marine, and property, and you can see that property is about half of that.
Next slide.
Slide number 8. These are, as I spoke before, these are some of the larger claims that we've paid out of the catastrophic reserve account. The Alaska Marine Highways Laconi grounding in May of 2004, the Crystal Lake Hatchery fire in March of 2014, just a little over $4 million for that. The Alaska Aerospace Launch Facility in August of 2014 was $1.5 million we paid, and that's what we paid out of the CAT fund. The PFAS claim starting in November of 2017, we paid a total of $5.8 million so far. And then, of course, the earthquake-related claims of November 2018, we've paid about $1.2. I did put that note down there. It may address what Senator Von Emhoff was talking about. In the last 10 years, this is the only claim the state has collected the excess insurance on, and that was the Kodiak Launch Facility.
So for the committee and those listening at home, PFAS is polyfluoral alkali. That's a firefighting foam required by the FAA at all our state managed runways. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. I hope the co-chair from SICA is not going to get upset that I used PFAS instead of what you just said, Mr. Chairman. But why is the state paying out PFAS claims? Shouldn't that be private companies who are responsible for that?
Through the chair, that's a great question. I mean, we initially looked at Fairbanks had come to us and said that they had this contamination release, and it got out into the residential wells. We looked at that as a potential liability claim, and we started looking at the costs to get everybody clean water. Initially, that started with bringing in bottled water, and then it eventually got to the permanent solution of hooking them up to the city water system. As we moved on, we started seeing, and we were never advised when it was in Fairbanks, we were never advised that there were other airports that were potentially the same problem, because our policies, we don't collect a premium for this type of incident, and our policies don't cover hazardous release. So we started looking at other airports, and we got to a point where we said, you know, let's step back and verify whether we actually owe for these. And we have five areas that we're covering for not only temporary water, but coming up with a final solution for clean water. And I believe DOT is going to take the lead after that on the cleanup areas. But the state is pursuing litigation against 3M and DuPont for the initial development of the chemicals.
And if you could put on the record, I don't believe the state of Alaska is not the only state. They're enjoining a class action suit with numerous other states. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I am not intimately involved in the litigation, but I believe this is just the state pursuing 3M and DuPont. I know there are other states that are doing the same as well, but I don't know if this is a class action suit with the other states.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Next slide.
The next slide is how the fund works and how we get it refunded or refilled every year. And I'm going to read that first paragraph to you because I am not an accountant, and this is what we were told this how this fund is set up. It's the State Insurance Catastrophic Reserve Fund, or Fund Number 3209. It's part of the general fund and other non-segregated investments, or JFONSI. The JFONSIs are funds that have been pooled together for investment purposes. The CAT fund is part of the non-MOU group, which allows for the interest earned to be deposited back into the general fund. And so that's how the fund is set up. Each year, if we spend anything out of the CAT fund, the first thing that goes back into the CAT fund is any funds left over directly from the Division of Risk Management. So if we have $1 million left over in our fund, that goes into the CAT fund. If that is not sufficient to fill the fund to the full $5 million unencumbered, then we ask Division of Finance to do a sweep of lapsed general funds and or UGFs, and they fill that fund to the full amount. And down below, you can see we're third on the list, but it shows the 18, 19, and 20 amounts that we have filled the account to.
Senator Von Himhoff and then Senator Stedman.
I will defer to Senator Stedman first.
Senator Stedman.
And then I'll go.
Okay, just again, I'm back to this lapse caper. If we're going to lapse, if I understand correctly, this proposal is to take lapse money, unused surplus in an agency at the end of the fiscal year, and then move it over to create this $50 million account. Is that correct? Is that what you got?
Through the chair, that's correct, Senator Seven.
Okay. The point I want to bring up, Mr. Chairman, is, you know, we've been spending a lot of time here trying to peel back the onion on the different fund sources so everybody can see the fiscal position of the state without the without the finance committee is maneuvering to make it artificially look something different than it is. I'm not so sure, Mr. Chairman, that if we do this program, we shouldn't just do an appropriation of $50 million into the fund. So it's very clean and simple. And this surplus money in the agencies, we should either be reducing their budget, taking that surplus money back out, and or lapsing that surplus money into the CBR, which we owe, as we all know, $10 billion plus dollars to. That's a kind of a separate discussion on how we want to handle that. And then the interagency receipts that are being charged to create these funds to cover these expenditures, we should maybe give it some thought of keeping in interagency receipts and as a self-funding mechanism. So this can be very easily tracked as time goes on, rather than just we schmooze everything out in the operating budget and all of a sudden $50 million accounts created. So I think we can work those details out, but it's just a point of caution, I guess, that I have, that we use as much transparency as possible.
Senator Von Imhoff, and then Senator Olson.
Thank you. So when you talk about lapse funds there, is this what we are referring to as the reverse sweep? So if the reverse sweep does not occur, then you will utilize, you'll do a sweep of excess funds in a whole bunch of different accounts to fund this $50 million. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, if we could have Paloma with OMB answer that question. I'm not sure that it's related to the reverse sweep.
Senator Stedman?
Yeah, maybe that's a good idea. We can have OMB answer the question. And the simpler way to ask it is, if we create this fund of $50 million, is it sweepable?
Paloma, have you heard the conversation at the table, and are you prepared to answer, or do we need to restate the question?
Chair Bishop, for the record, Paloma Harbor, I did hear the questions, and I'll do my best to answer. So the lapse balances, the unrestricted lapse that we put into the CAT fund if needed at the end of the fiscal year and only if needed, is done before the sweep occurs, so during the reappropriation period. So the general funds are taken from the appropriations they were appropriated to the CAT fund at the end of the fiscal year, if we know they're not needed to cover expenses, before the sweep of the general fund to the CBR even occurs. And then to answer Senator Stedman's question, the CAT fund is not sweepable because it is not subject to further appropriation.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So I understand the current ability or the current practice of putting in a couple million, you know, less than $5 million in the account. How are you going to fund $50 million?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, it depends obviously on the fiscal year. Most fiscal years we do not have that much in lapse balance at the end of the fiscal year. We do actually anticipate having a very significant lapse balance at the end of FY fiscal year 2021 because of a lot of federal COVID stimulus funding coming in, specifically enhanced federal match on our Medicaid program. We know we're going to have a significant lapse balance there. There might be others, but we didn't expect to have $50 million in lapse balances in one fiscal year.
Senator Von Imhoff, then Senator Stedman.
Thank you. So what you're saying is that you're going to be eyeballing potential federal COVID money, and you highlighted Medicaid money for a building insurance fund?
No, I'm sorry. To clarify, we did not spend as much general funds on Medicaid as was anticipated when we developed the FY21 budget because there was additional federal participation in the program. So we know that's one area where we'll have significant general fund lapse. There may be others. That's what I meant to say.
Senator Stedman.
I think, Mr. Chairman, that goes to my point earlier that when we look at this COVID money coming in from multiple sources in the billions, we're going to have a lot of opportunity to offset general funds. And those general fund offset can be used to pay a higher dividend, increase our expenditures, go to savings, go to capital budget, the main items. I think the committee should be careful when we offset general funds that we clearly understand what we're offsetting. In other words, we take COVID money and offset the general funds and use the general funds for one of those other categories, that we consider using a couple extra steps. And for instance, in this case, with a $50 million sweep issue or lapsing issue, that we take the money out of the general fund, even though we might be putting money back into the general fund from several other locations. Debt service is one of them. That's clearly a game to be offset. So, again, just a cautionary note. Otherwise, we're going to have a lot of parts moving around the table, and it's going to be hard for everybody to understand what's under all the shells as we start moving them around. I'd just as soon not have the shells on the table. So everybody's got a clear view of the peanut. And if this particular, like in this example, if it's $50 million and we agree to it, it's $50 million, just what it is. But clearly in the light of day, we take an appropriation from the general fund, put it in there, and then we can clearly track it over time. I think it's just going to be cleaner. I don't fault the department for coming up with a lapse scenario. They have to come up with something, but we're the appropriators. We should decide how much clarity we want, and I would urge the committee to err on the side of transparency.
Thank you for your comments. Any other questions? Senator Olson was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it looks like the lapsed funds that you reference here are should go through the appropriate the reappropriation route and the guidelines that go with that, as opposed to just being shuffled around by a non-legislative body. What am I missing that makes it so that's not a reappropriation?
Paloma, did you hear Senator?
Yes.
Could you answer Senator Olson's question, please?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Olson, the operating budget bill includes language specifically saying that if there is excess general fund at the end of the fiscal year that is going to lapse, we can use it to replenish these funds, including the CAT fund, up to the certain amount set in statute. So it is in the actual appropriation bill, and it's appropriated by the legislature that we can do this with lapsing general funds. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chairman, let me clarify, what's the difference between what they're trying to do here, which has it looks like it's just a shuffle, as opposed to going through the reappropriation guidelines that are much more complex and more with a lot more oversight. Is there somebody trying to avoid the reappropriation process?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it's a matter of, as Senator Stedman articulated, it's your choice how you fund the program. If you choose to fund the program, we've been able to use lapsed fund balances and very moderate lapsed fund balances. If you look at the historical slide, a couple hundred thousand here and there, to keep the fund balance up.
I meant to preface it by a follow-up to what Senator Stedman had talked about.
Senator Stedman?
Okay. Yes, the language section of the operating budget has got limits on it. Clearly, we can put the limits, set it at 50 if we want to, 50 million. I would prefer that we don't do that. I would prefer that the chairman ask for the fiscal note to be reconsidered and viewed as a standalone appropriation into it. I think it just makes it cleaner for everybody to understand. The net effect to the Treasury is going to be the same, but it would make it cleaner for everybody to follow. At some point coming along here with the operating budget, we'll have to have that discussion how we're going to, keep the lapse situation and reconstituting funds under control, because we're going to hopefully free up several hundred million dollars over three fiscal years.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Okay, is that our last slide?
Mr. Chairman, that is the last slide.
Okay. All right, thank you. Next, we're gonna go to public testimony. We'll open public testimony. 2 minutes for all presenters. Charles McKee, Anchorage.
Yes, I'm a holder. Yes, my name's Charles McKee. I'm a holder due course to my account. And to answer Ivan Hoff's query as to what's happening to the insurance carriers, it's the people going into incarceration across the country, state by state, it collectively, all those accounts go off book. Understand? So they get funneled into the court of Interventory Bank of Transfer. That's the court. Each state has their own court. So it's transferred into the Bar Association, which controls all the corporations across the country. You're referring to them as states. And so I make reference to 31 U.S.C. 1321, whereabouts unknown, the individuals of that account. I'm not one of those. That's the United States Corporation. And currently I'm out on bail. I'm being charged with a crime. And I'm against the administration and the current court. And they appropriated $80 million and gave it to the Doctors and Nurses Association. This is the Department of Administration, October the 2nd. I had a case, still have the case in court, but they decided to put it aside because there was no motion applied to the notice of cure, and the remedy was the amount of money plus return my dogs to me. So I didn't know that I had an agent, a public agent, a clerk of court, working with me and for me, also for the state. And she is also Department of Corrections personnel. She was looking for favoritism for her son, who was incarcerated in Seward, which is where she was employed temporarily and then left to meet with me, which I didn't know that was hers.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. McKee. Your time is up. All right. We're at a point where is there any further committee discussion on SB 88 before we set this bill aside? Seeing none, SB 88 is set aside. We're going to take a brief at ease. Don't anybody go anywhere, please. We're going to pass out an amendment. Brief at ease. Call the committee back to order. SB 10, free reduced tuition for essential worker. This is the third hearing of SB 10. We heard public testimony on April 8th. Our intent is to consider amendments today. Senator Begich and Ms. Tobin, would you please come before the committee and put yourselves on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Begich. I'm the State Senator for District J, and with me is my staff assistant, Lukey Gail Tobin, who has worked on this bill with me.
Thank you, and if you'd just give us a quick snapshot, Senator Begich, on the bill again, and then we'll go into amendments.
Sure. Very quickly, this bill would provide for essential workers who were either temporarily laid off, or were essentially kept on the job to serve us during the pandemic, the opportunity for up to 4 years of free tuition at one of our state institutions. That is it in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman. It's we made one small error, which I think you're going to correct, which was a $30 million error, but we're going to correct that, and without adding any more to this very lengthy meeting, I will stop there and be open for questions.
Thank you, Senator Begich. Seeing no questions from committee members, we have four amendments, and I'll ask the members to move their own, and I'll move my amendment. The chair has an amendment, amendment number one.
Check.
Amendment number one, corrects the fiscal note on page 3, line 4, deletes $10 million, and inserts $2.5 million. This seeks to correct an inconsistency between the intent of the bill and the language in the legislation. The intent, as I understand it, is to appropriate $10 million total over 4 years. This language is written allows for the $10 million per year. Amendment one, number one clarifies that up to only $2.5 million is available for appropriation each fiscal year, not $10 million per year.
I'll remove my objection to the amendment, adoption of amendment number one.
Any further objection to amendment number one? Seeing none, amendment number one passes. Amendment number two.
Mr. Chair, amendment number two will not be offered.
Thank you. Amendment number two will not be offered. Amendment number three.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number three.
I will object for discussion.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Amendment number three adds a section to the bill recommending that at least 20% of these grants go to training institutions, i.e. trade schools. Basically, Mr. Chairman, there is a shortage of skilled labor throughout our nation and within our state. This amendment provides a suggestion to the legislature how to have a balance to this program by designating 20% of these grants to public trade schools. We're ensuring that these grants are used to help prepare a workforce needed for our future of our state, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I would like Noah Klein from Legislative Legal to speak to amendment number three.
For the record, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal. I'm sorry, Chair, I didn't hear a question.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Senator Wilson, would you?
Yeah, Mr. Klein, I believe you sent a memo out, and I believe there's questions at the committee table asking about the constitutionality of amendment number three.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, Article 7, Section 1 of the Alaska Constitution prohibits the expenditure of public funds for the direct benefit of a private educational institution. And so amendment number three raises questions under that section because it allows potentially for these funds to be spent for the direct benefit of private vocational schools.
Thank you, Mr. Klein.
And if I could, Mr. Chair?
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I believe there is a longstanding precedent going forth of what Mr. Klein is referring to. I believe that's more toward K-12 type education. The Alaska Performance Scholarship Program funds over a dozen of these type of programs currently, from hairdressers, barbers, driver training, nurse trades, the nurses' aides, welders, construction workers, truck drivers, throughout the state, and aviation maintenance. We also have a precedent set by the previous COVID funding, funding higher education funds to Alaska Bible College, Alaska Career, Alaska Christian College, Alaska Pacific University, several times over. And so, Mr. Chair, we've done this consistently throughout the past few decades of our state. So if there is a constitutionality, then we need to stop funding all those programs immediately.
Mr. Klein, you have a comment on the senator's comments?
For the record, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair to Senator Wilson. I haven't thought specifically about those programs, and if you'd like me to, I can get back to the committee on those programs. I would like to point out, though, that the Alaska Supreme Court precedent that we have was a post-secondary institution case. So it wasn't a primary secondary school. It was Sheldon Jackson College versus State, where it's the only place where the Alaska Supreme Court has gone into any real detail about this provision and provided a three-part test for how the court will determine whether or not public funds are providing a direct benefit to a private educational institution.
Thank you. Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Begich, for the record, 2 points. Just the CARES Act funds had a requirement in them to fund private schools. Actually, that was a federal requirement in the CARES Act first. And secondarily, I'm not opposed to the principle that is being discussed by Senator Wilson. I just, you know, I'm concerned with the memo that questions the constitutionality of the amendments, but the principle is well understood that the expansion makes sense, always makes sense to expand our support of students, but I'm concerned about the constitutionality.
Thank you, Senator Begich. Senator Wilson?
Yeah, maybe, Mr. Chair, if Santa Heffern is online from the Alaska Post Secondary Education, could possibly talk about how we fund these current programs currently.
Ms. Efford, are you on the line and are you following the conversation?
Yes, good morning. For the record, this is Santa Efford, Director, Executive Director for the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. And through the chair, under Alaska Statute 1443.830, we have institutional authorization under our statute that we actually qualify certain post-secondary institutions based on various eligibility categories, and those under institutions are able then to receive funding from the Alaska Performance Scholarship and the Alaska Education Grant under our statute.
Thank you. Brief at ease, just for a second. Back on the record. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the maker of the amendment, I'm just curious if the current bill is limited to being used to state-supported post-secondary educational institutions. So that would be in Alaska. And I'm just curious if the way this is written, it would allow for funds to be expended on institutions outside the state.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. The intent was for it to be used within the state of Alaska. We were not looking to include outside schools with this amendment. So would it allow? We don't know. But the intent was for inside the state of Alaska.
I think amendment number 3 needs some more thought and work, so I'm going to maintain my objection, but I'm going to also ask that the maker of the amendment work with my office and Senator Begich as this bill travels along.
And, Mr. Chair, after further discussion, we will rework this and we will withdraw amendment number 3 to a later time and date to work on this at a later time out of this committee.
Thank you. We've withdrawn amendment number 3 by the maker. Amendment number 4.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move amendment number 4.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Yes, Mr. Chair, this amendment is similar to the other amendment, which sort of go in tandem to allow the replace the state-supported post-secondary institution with the post-secondary education institution approved by the Commission of Post-Secondary Education. And this would allow, as Ms. Effort said, to allow them to use grants to be used for both state-supported institutions and private institutions.
Discussion, committee members. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe if we could get an opinion from our legislative attorney on this one as well. But I guess I would just mention this appears to have the same problem as the previous one, in that it appears to open it up to educational institutions outside of Alaska. But I'm curious, a legal opinion from our attorney, if this is constitutional.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski. Did the Senator Begich want to make a comment? Did I see that first or no? Okay. I'm sorry. It's hard to read. I'm getting better at reading people through the mask, but not 100% yet. So we'll go to Noah Klein, Legislative Legal.
Through the chair, for the record, again, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services, to Senator Wilkowski. I do think the same constitutional question arises with this amendment, and that's not to say that I can guarantee what a court would do. I think the court would apply the same direct benefit test depending on what institutions were actually receiving the funds, what institutions were approved by the commission.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilson.
I believe Ms. Heffernan already talked about the mechanisms that are already in place in statutes to allow them to currently do this, and this is just bringing this bill more in line to what's already currently in practice. Again, if that practice is not constitutional, I would recommend this committee just take a strong look at changing those statutes to make sure that we conform with the Constitution of Alaska.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? I'll remove my objection. Any maintain the objection?
Yes.
Senator Wilkowski, is that a yes?
I object, Mr. Chair. And again, I guess I'm just concerned about the constitutionality of it and the potential to allow for institutions outside of Alaska to be funded, which I think is, goes against the intent. I guess I'd ask the bill sponsor, if I could, Mr. Chair, if he has a position on this.
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, Senator Begich, for the record, it is not the intent for this bill to apply to sending state money out of state in the form of grants. It is for state institutions for state residents and state, those in the state that were serving in those roles. So the way that the language reads to me, it appears to apply to all the institutions that would be approved by the Post-Secondary Education Commission. So I would have difficulty with this. I don't think it meets the intent of the bill. The First Amendment does. This amendment, in my opinion, does not.
Santa, Ms. Efrid, question for me, how much, if any, money does the state post-secondary administration approve for money going out of state for education and training?
Chair Bishop, this is again for the record, Santa Efrid, Executive Director of the Commission on Post-Secondary Education. Money that is appropriated as grants under the Alaska Performance Scholarship and the Alaska Education Grant do not go to students out of state. They, in our statute, that money, the performance scholarship and the grants, are for to provide scholarships for high school graduates who are Alaska residents to attend a qualified post-secondary institution, which again is qualified under the other statute that I previously stated, that are for institutions in the state of Alaska.
So as you read this amendment,
Chair Bishop, I think we might need to work on the amendment to reference that it would be, or add possibly, that it is for post-secondary institutions approved by the commission in the state, but I'm happy to work with Senator Wilson to determine how this would best. But currently, performance scholarship money and education grants do not go to students out of state or institutions out of state for students.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff and then Senator Olson.
Thank you. perhaps if the maker of the amendment could just refine it, just to add the language that it's Alaska-based institutions only, just to make it clear, even though to some degree it's redundant because we just heard that post-secondary education doesn't do that, but just make it very clear. And if it's possible to get the report that you're referring to, that the state is already funding several other organizations, including private institutions, but just the different organizations that we've been funding. And I personally, Mr. Chairman, would feel comfortable waiting a day for the to act on this bill to get this new information and to see if this amendment makes sense. And then I'll just throw a wrench in the whole thing as well, and just to ask the maker of the bill, the sponsor of the bill, is if we're talking about essential workers, I know that we've had some essential workers here that have been out of state. Maybe they've come up here to be in the healthcare facility or in the healthcare industry. Are we talking just Alaska residences? Alaska residents? And if so, is that clearly stated in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, to Senator Van Himoff through the chair, the Senator Begich for the record, it is not intended to limit it to Alaska residents, and there's nothing in the bill that does that. Students can, under this bill, it is for essential workers as defined in the governor's disaster declaration order that's referred to in the commentary before and in the bill itself. So no, it's not intended to do that, though usually it will be those folks who do it. I would just add, the way that the amendment's written, Mr. Chairman, the way that the amendment's written is it's programs approved by the Alaska Post-Secondary Education. I have received a loan in the past from the Post-Secondary Education Commission to go to out-of-state colleges. It doesn't specifically reference the two areas in this amendment that we are looking at that were referred to by Director Eifert. So I just, to clarify the record on that, we approve institutions outside of the state of Alaska to receive student loans.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Am I reading their objection correctly that if you have a facility or an institution outside the state of Alaska that is private, that you're not allowing students to, or you're not paying, or not allowing the funds to go that direction or to follow the students? And I guess I'd bring this up because if you were going to go to a medical school or law school, which we don't have here in the state of Alaska, are you saying that is the objection is that you can't get the funding cannot go to that institution?
Through the chair to Senator Olson, the bill was narrowly designed to take advantage of the moment and to apply it to Alaskan institutions to avoid the constitutional challenges that we anticipated. It was to ensure that those who were essential workers in the state of Alaska would have an opportunity to pursue a four-year education within the limits of what's available within the state of Alaska and at public institutions within the state of Alaska, including AvTech, Prince William Sound Community College, and the University of Alaska, since they are the only public institutions in the state of Alaska.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
We're going to take a brief at ease. Back on the record. Senator Wilson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will, in light of this wonderful conversation, we will withdraw amendment number 4 for further refinement.
And the committee is going to set this bill aside, and we're going to the floor.
Mr. Chairman, one quick clarification. On page 2, line 7, it does say has been a resident of the state for at least 12 months. So it is, I want to clarify that. Thank you.
Okay, committee, we're setting this bill aside. Next meeting's tomorrow, 9 a.m., April 22nd.